We're here with Mark Knowles. Mark, how are you doing today?
Awesome. Thanks for having me on. Appreciate it.
Yeah, I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us today. Obviously, the Courtside Sessions podcast is really geared towards junior players and their parents. And hopefully through our conversation today, they can take away some tips, some insight, and help them all along with their careers.
Yeah, most definitely.
So I think a great place to start would be maybe to learn a little bit about how you got into tennis and what your junior career looked like. I know you got to the finals of the Junior French Open. You had a highest ranking of number 12. And then you also trained with Nick Bollettieri. So I think you probably had a pretty unique junior career.
Yeah, most definitely. You know, the way I got into tennis originally, my mom was a professional player, you know, kind of amateur professional days. She's from England. So she played, you know, like Wimbledon back in the amateur days, played mixed doubles and so forth, played some doubles. So she was a teaching pro in the Bahamas. When she met my dad, they both taught tennis at just a local club at a hotel there. So, you know, I was around tennis from a really young age, you know, and hearing, obviously I don't remember, but my parents told me, you know, I think when I was about 3 years old, I started hitting tennis balls all the time. And then, you know, obviously I gravitated to it immediately. I loved the sport. And, you know, I would just, they had a wall like on the fourth court, and I literally would just go hit on the wall for probably 8 hours a day. Basically the wall was my babysitter. You know, my parents were obviously teaching tennis for the entire day. So they would be like, I was on the last court, just hitting against the wall literally all day. So that was really how it started. And then I was pretty fortunate. My parents ran a lot of tennis clinics and so forth in the Bahamas. Obviously it's a very small country. But growing up in the 70s, tennis was pretty popular. Especially 'cause when my mom came over, you know, she kind of brought her tennis influence and the clubs and the community was really into tennis. So they ran a bunch of tennis camps. And fortunately for me, you know, it was a lot of my friends. So I didn't really realize that, obviously I loved tennis already from a young age, but it was so much fun for me. You know, we would have these tennis camps, especially in summer, you know, where we'd hang out. And some of my friends still to this day are my friends from those summer camps back when we were, you know, 7, 8 years old, 6 years old. So, you know, that's kind of how I got into it. And, you know, my memories, even though the Bahamas is a small country, they had a pretty good tennis community. Like it was, I don't know, I kind of remember most of my younger years as just being at tennis courts and running around, picking up tennis balls, being a ball boy, you know, all these things. We were fortunate. I remember one of my earliest memories was Gene Scott, formerly, unfortunately, has passed away, but he was very instrumental in helping tennis in the Bahamas. And he brought Bjorn Borg and Vitas Gerulaitis and a couple others to the Bahamas. I think I was about 9 years old. And Borg was my idol. So, you know, I got to see him in person. I still remember it like it was yesterday. He crossed the road right in front of our car. I still have the exact picture of it in my mind. But it was very impactful, obviously, right? Coming from a small country to see the person you've been watching on TV winning Wimbledon, winning the French. That was awesome. So that was really cool. You know, then an important part for me, my parents were very supportive of my tennis young, played a lot of tournaments just locally. I would obviously play, I was, you know, probably pretty good for a junior. So I would play a lot of the senior tournaments being a small country. And then I started to go away to the Orange Bowl. It's a huge junior tournament in Florida. So I think the first year I went over there to play the 12 and unders, I would have been, I guess I would have been 9 years old. Yeah, I went pretty young. And Nick Bollettieri, fortunately, came up to my mom and said, you know, I really think your son has some talent. I'd be interested in him coming to the academy, which was in Bradenton, Florida. And, you know, I was obviously kind of jumped at the opportunity. I think my parents were a little bit apprehensive, you know, sending a 10-year-old away to Bradenton, Florida. You know, back then we didn't have social media and all those things. It was just a payphone. So it seemed like it was a trillion miles away. But, you know, that was fortunate, right, to get that opportunity. You know, unfortunately, Nick Bollettieri just passed away. But, you know, I owe pretty much everything that I've achieved in tennis, which, you know, essentially ends up meaning what you achieved in life. Because, you know, that's the great thing about tennis is that even if you don't become a professional or a collegiate player, you learn so many instrumental life lessons competing in tennis as a junior, right? It's a one-on-one sport. It tells you a lot about yourself. You've got to learn how to deal with adversity. You know, a lot of key components to being a well-rounded person come through tennis. So, like I said, I owe everything to Nick. You know, I was fortunate, went there when I was 10 years old. So I think it was back in 1981, quite a while ago. And, you know, it was very strict. You know, back then it was, you know, he had a military background. It was very strict. You know, I think I remember there were three D's: discipline, determination, and one more. But, you know, discipline was the big one that it really stood out, and the academy and Nick taught us great discipline. And then I was fortunate, you know, we had a lot of great players back then. You know, my closest friends, Andre Agassi, Jim Courier, David Wheaton, Martin Blackman, David Kassman, Chris Garner. The list can go on of great junior players, and a lot went on to have great professional careers, great collegiate careers. So I had a lot of, you know, a lot of competition, which was great. We would play junior tournaments pretty much every weekend in Florida, you know. So coming from the Bahamas, it gave me an opportunity to play a lot more tournaments, which was important back then, especially. You know, and so that was pretty much my juniors. You know, I played some of the U.S. Nationals. I won the indoors when I was 16. Got to play, coming from the Bahamas, I got to play the junior Grand Slams a little bit earlier maybe than others. Played well in those, the French, U.S. Open, maybe quarters or semis, juniors. So, you know, did pretty well. I wasn't the best junior, but I was a top-ranked junior player. So I was kind of on the cusp, you know, alongside better junior players than me, whether it be Agassi, Courier, Cass, Martin Blackman, a lot of great players. The names, like I said, could go on and on. But, you know, so I kind of had that decision, and we were fortunate. We were part of a traveling team at Bollettieri, so we were allowed to go play professional events while we were still amateurs. So I remember Jim, Andre, a guy named Ned Caswell, Jim Courier, Chris Garner. There was probably seven or eight of us, Doug Flack. There were a number of us that got a chance to play for a year. And I graduated high school when I was young. I graduated high school when I was 16. So I felt like going to university right away might have been a little bit soon. And I was kind of on the cusp of, you know, whether to turn pro or not. So we got to play for about, you know, I took a year off in between high school and college. So played professionally and, you know, and did well, didn't do as well as maybe Andre and Jim did immediately, but I had some good results. But I actually felt that I wasn't really mature enough to go out in the international world that tennis is and kind of tackle that. And, you know, we didn't really come from much money either. So it wasn't like I had a ton of financial backing. So it was either, you know, sponsorship or nothing. So then I ended up going to school at UCLA, which was a great experience as well. Went there for 3 years, you know, had a great time there, developed my game, had some great friendships, and then turned pro after my junior year. And, you know, obviously kind of the rest is history as far as my career, and then played for a long time.
Yeah, I know. That's an unbelievable junior career and into college, too. You accomplished so much coming from where you came from, and getting that opportunity to train with Nick sounds like a really kind of instrumental part of your career. And I think that for a lot of junior families out there that are kind of on the fence of embracing that academy culture and everything like that, would you have any advice for them? It sounds like it was a positive experience for you, but I think that's probably something that a lot of families weigh.
Yeah, I think it depends on the individual, right? I mean, I think I was a bit rare in the fact that, especially coming from the Bahamas, a small place, going away, and like I said, we didn't have much means growing up. We didn't have much money, so I literally came home twice a year. I came home at Christmas, and I came home in the summer. Other than that, I was gone the entire time from my family and my parents. So, you know, that can be tough. And listen, of course, there were times where I missed my family and all of those things. I was only 10 years old. So that's a bit hard. And being a father myself, we have three kids, my wife and I probably would have never let any of our kids leave at that young of age. So, you know, it was good that my parents allowed me to, because I actually wanted to do it because I felt that it was, you know, it was kind of my opportunity to be successful. I didn't know if I would ever get that opportunity again, being in a small country like the Bahamas with very limited resources. I mean, we're not a big country, you know, especially in tennis back then. So that was kind of my motivation. I think for junior parents, I mean, I think it depends on the individual. Like I said, I was pretty clear with what my goals were. I swam as well. I was a swimmer. I was a really good swimmer in the Bahamas till about 12 years old. And then I kind of had to give it up between both of them. But generally, I was all in on tennis. Like I love tennis and I still love tennis. I'm so thankful that I got to play the great sport of tennis, you know, which isn't everyone's attitude, right? I think the most important thing is I think try to let your kid, you know, try to talk about what it means, what the ramifications are, right? You're going to be away from home if you're in academy. If you stay here, okay, hopefully we have the same level of coaching. If it's a drop in coaching, then maybe, you know, it's something, hey, if your goals are to be as good as you can be or, you know, get a college scholarship and maybe have a chance to play professionally, do you want to make the sacrifice? Do you want to make the effort to be in the best situation, you know, to fulfill your potential? Because ultimately, it's hard to know what a kid's potential is, right? But my mindset has always been like, I know having been through those years, you know, from 10 to 17, those formative years where kids are finding themselves, finding out how good they are, what their athleticism is, what their potential is, that you truly have to have a love and passion for it. If the student or the junior or the kid doesn't really love it, ultimately, it's probably not going to work out, right? I mean, maybe one in, I don't know, 250,000 maybe, but it's just not going to work out. There's too many other things to kind of detract from where their goals should be. So I think, you know, it's just one of those things where I know it's hard in today's world, especially I was fortunate, like I said, because I don't know if there are any academy setups that are quite as good as Nick Bollettieri's was back then. Like I said, I mean, we had, you know, I think we probably had 5 of the top 10 juniors in every age group, male and female, right? So the competition was just so elevated, which allowed us to, you know, it was a Lord of the Rings atmosphere. We just competed like animals against each other for Nick's recognition, the chance to go on stadium hard court or stadium clay court. You know, so we elevated ourselves. And you know, we were fortunate because we also had professionals to look up to at the time. I remember when I went there, you know, Jimmy Arias was a top 10 player. Aaron Krikstein was a top 10 player. Carling Bassett Sagusa was a top 10 player. I mean, so we actually had people that, you know, came through the system, trained there, we practice with. So it made it seem like it's real, right? It's a possibility. I'm not as familiar with all the academies now. I know there's some great academies out there, but I know obviously economically it's hard to facilitate a bunch of probably to congregate that much talent, obviously, because there are costs involved. But, you know, like I said, I think academies, you know, I think I went to IMG academies about 4 or 5 years ago, and it's changed drastically since I went there. And it was great when I was there, but now it's at a whole nother level, right? So I always say now that, you know, if I had a kid that was passionate and loved the sport, and now, of course, they have many other sports there at IMG Academies, but, you know, tennis specifically, if they were really passionate about it, it would be hard not to send them there because it's got everything, right? And there, I'm sure there are other academies, whether it's the Everett Tennis Academy or any other academy, I'm sure they have everything, right? The ability to allow a kid, a junior, to be in the best environment, the most competitive environment, and also have the opportunity to fulfill their potential.
Yeah, I think that's a lot of great insight there. And the couple big things that stuck out were that the player, it's all about the individual, and they have to be passionate about the game and really buy into the process and be committed and have goals and all that kind of stuff. And then one other thing that really stuck out, I think, was your comment on competition. I would love to for you to elaborate a little bit more about what being in a competitive environment did for you, like your junior development and everything like that. Because I think that that's something that I talk to juniors about all the time, is putting themselves in those uncomfortable competitive situations, because long term that'll help their growth. So I'd love to hear about your opinion on that.
It's huge. I mean, it's probably the most vital characteristic, right? The ability to compete and face adversity. And that's why tennis is such a unique sport. And it's not for everyone, right? It's a sport where you're judged daily, right? I mean, you're competing every single day. And it doesn't, I think one of the things that's important to know, you know, I know there are a lot of different paths in juniors. And whether you know, listen, the Williams sisters didn't play junior tournaments, whatever, but, you know, their parents instilled the competitive desire. So that it doesn't mean that you have to play a ton of tournaments or don't have to play, but it means that you have to understand what it means to compete, right? Compete means, you know, put it all on the line each and every day, because ultimately, if you want to get to your furthest goal, which is to be a professional tennis player, you know, as someone who played professionally for over 20 years, you compete every single day, right? Whether you're the number one seed, it doesn't give you a 3-love lead in the next match, right? You start right from the start, and, you know, you got to compete you have to prove yourself every single day, right? There's, you know, you get a little bit of sponsorship, but it's not a team sport, right? Your contracts aren't guaranteed. You're not guaranteed a spot in the top 100 or the top 50 for 3+ years or 4 years, right? It's not a contract. You could have a big year 1 year and play bad the next year, and next thing you know, you're outside the top 100 and, you know, things are falling apart. So that's where I think it's important. And I know the junior landscape has changed, obviously, with UTR and so many other things where colleges look specifically at that. You know, I don't know how much colleges still look outside the box and look for potential. Hopefully they still do, because as we know, lots of juniors, you know, I mean, those years are very tricky years. Kids develop differently, right? You know, I can think, and I won't even mention names, but I can think of a number of pros that end up being number one in the world Grand Slam champions that weren't necessarily great juniors, but they had the potential, they had the skill set, they maybe had the ability to compete, maybe didn't know how to, you know, keep the ball in play maybe as long as some other 12-year-olds. But, you know, there's other factors. I think tennis is probably one of the most complicated sports to predict future success. You know, it's obvious, right? If you're a 12 year old and you're super consistent and you don't ever miss, you know, you're probably going to win a ton of matches, right? There's going to probably be a kid that's a little bit more errors, blah, 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 but he may have the long-term potential, right? So that's where I'm saying you've got to have the flexibility to still identify talent. But I think the most important thing though, is you can't shy away from competition. You know, I've seen some kids that, you know, they look great, they play the part, and then when it comes to actually competing one-on-one combat, you know, they kind of check out. And unfortunately, there's no teammates in tennis, right? So you can't call timeouts. Okay, now there's a little bit more coaching at the professional level, but essentially, historically, you know, there's been no coach, no timeouts, no teammates. It's just up to the person on the court, to problem solve. So that's where competing is super important.
I love that. And I couldn't agree with you more. I would also love to hear a little bit about kind of your mindset when you were a junior player. Was your goal to develop into a pro? Did you want to play in college? Where was your head at when you were coming up through juniors in terms of your future, your career goals, all that kind of stuff?
Yeah, I was probably delusional. I mean, because literally from a 9-10 year old, I wanted to be number one in the world, and I thought I would be number one in the world, and those were my goals, right? To be the best tennis player I could be, which, you know, like I said, a little bit delusional, right? But I think sometimes you need those types of goals, right? You need something to shoot for the stars. And I think that's what propelled me. You know, obviously I put a lot of pressure on myself too, which was a detriment at times throughout my junior career, even throughout my professional career, but it's because I wanted it so badly, right? I wanted to win every match. I wanted to be number one in the world. I wanted to win tournaments. I wanted to be the best. So with that comes pressure. So then, you know, the battle then is to kind of moderate the intensity. So, you know, it's kind of interesting, but it's important. You know, I think that we see even more nowadays with, you know, we get the benefit of seeing all these documentaries and these biographies of some of the all-time greats in various sports. And, you know, the common thread is that they don't let anyone tell them that they can't achieve, right? So, like, you know, the one thing I've learned throughout my years, you know, around sports and competing, which I wish I knew even more when I played, is how strong the mind is, right? Like, never think that you can't achieve something. You know, it's the mind is the most powerful thing, regardless of size, regardless of speed, regardless of athleticism. if your mind believes it can take you to a place, you're probably going to get there. And so obviously I have the years to reflect back now, but when you're a teenager and when you're a junior, you don't, it's hard to digest that, right? And so I think that's where you need the fine balance where you need the parents to be supportive and educational, right? Because they have the experience, right? They have the experience, whether they played the sport or didn't play the sport. Tennis sports is kind of a microcosm of life. You know, I mean, we're, even in life, you face adversity, right? It's how you handle adversity. How do you respond? And you learn those lessons in sports, but especially in tennis, which is, you know, there are no excuses. You can't, you know, I've referenced it already. There are no timeouts. There are no coaches, nobody to help you. You've got to figure it out or you're going to lose. And then you've got to deal with those consequences, which, you know, I lost a lot in my career. Nobody, at least I didn't, but a lot of people I know don't like to lose. So, you know, when you get home at night and look in the mirror and you lost, you know, there's no, it's only you, right? So, so it takes a certain character, it takes certain integrity, certain mindset to get through that.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of gems in what you just said there. And it's really cool to see that your mindset that you had as a junior paid off because you ended up reaching that pinnacle. You know, you were not only an All-American at UCLA, but when you made the transition to going pro in 1992, had a lot of success in the pro ranks. You know, 4 Grand Slam titles. You were in the top 100 in singles too, which was the highest ranked for any players from the Bahamas. And you did reach that world number one ranking. So very cool to see that. I think I would love to hear how your transition went from being an All-American at UCLA and then getting into the pro ranks.
Yeah, I mean, it was interesting, right? I went to, like I said, I had a year there to decide whether to go pro or go to school. You know, growing up in the Bahamas, the opportunity to go to a school like UCLA, right, it seems so far off. So when they were interested in me coming, it was, you know, it was awesome. So I obviously was very excited at the opportunity to play at UCLA. You know, storied program, athletically, academically, great place, great coaches. Had the late Glenn Bassett was my head coach, and the present head coach was my assistant, Billy Martin. And then there were some great assistants as well. Brett Greenwood, Ron Jenkins. So, you know, they were great. And I think they understood, you know, they knew that it was a pathway for me to go to the professionals, to go to the professional tour, right? So I was, they knew going in, I was one of those kids that was thinking pros. So that helped, you know, but it's funny when you get to college, your goals shift a little bit because you come part of a team, which is so unique. You've never been part of a team. You've been playing as an individual your whole life. And it's super cool, right? The college experience is awesome. You get to compete as a team. You know, unfortunately for me, some of my worst memories are from college because 2 of my 3 years, we were the number one team in the country. And we didn't win the team title. So I look back just bummed that we didn't because you wanted to win it for your teammates, your coaches, super cool. But, you know, those experiences also, they shape you, right? And, you know, failure is, I mean, I know it sounds cliche, but failure is when you learn the most about yourself. So, you know, I think that UCLA was great for me. It was really fun, allowed me a chance to mature. I almost turned pro after my sophomore year. I was ready to go. My game was ready. But I actually came back. I took the fall off, played some pro tournaments, and then came back in January just because we were ranked number one in the country. We had an amazing team. You know, we should have won it, obviously. Unfortunately, we didn't. So I came back for the glory of trying to win NCAA team championship. You know, but like I said, once again, fell short. And then I felt that it was, I think we were losing a couple guys, and for me it was time to go pro. My game was ready, my mind was ready, and so then that's kind of what went into that decision.
That's awesome. I would love to hear a little bit about your opinion for all those kind of players that are maybe on the fence about trying to go pro right out of their junior career versus going to college. Do you think that college experience it sounds like it's beneficial for you, but would you have any advice for somebody that's in that position?
I think it's a really smart choice. It really is, because now, especially now, I mean, from when I first turned pro in 92, as you mentioned, to now, players are playing way older now as professionals, right? With the advancements in the physical, the recovery, the way these guys work out. I mean, you know, these athletes nowadays, they're bigger, better, stronger. Their bodies last longer. So there's not quite that pressure, right? It's their careers have kind of expanded. So longer, you know, we see what, you know, Federer did for such a long time. Novak still playing an incredibly high level. You know, these guys, there was a generation where I think most pros retired ended, you know, late 20s, early 30s. Now it's kind of the norm to play into the mid 30s. So that's expanded the professional career. So not maybe the same urgency to go out on tour as a 17, 18 year old. And I think what's important, and we're seeing that with great, great results from the collegiate players on both tours, ATP tour and the WTA tour, that it's showing you that these players had a chance to develop their game, maybe had a more normal routine. So they're better adapted for the tour when they get there, right? They haven't had to deal with those early pressures, maybe the disappointments, the failures. They got a chance to mature as an individual. You know, if you look at, there's tons of college guys on the ATP tour that are in the top 75. It's incredible. I know three of them are from UCLA, which is awesome. And on the women's side, same thing. You know, Danielle Collins, just to name a couple, doing great. But I think also, if I think back to my time, it was the same. We had a ton of college guys do well. I know on the men's side, we had, you know, myself, Alex O'Brien, Jonathan Stark, Jared Palmer, just to name a couple. All those guys were between top 30 in the world in singles and, you know, top one or two in doubles. So they had incredible careers. So I think, you know, maybe after that, there was a shift where guys weren't going to college. But now I think the focus has shifted, like, wow, okay, you know, look at a guy like Chris Eubanks, right? Breaks through 6 years after, you know, being on the lower tour, but very mature, able to handle maybe the failures and disappointments that come with losing initially when you come on tour. Because let's face it, you know, when you're a great junior or whatever you are, number one in the world, but once you get on tour, you know, it's kind of like football. When you're going from college to the NFL, everybody's the guy, right? And so it's the same on the tour. Once you get, everybody's the guy, right? Everybody's great. Everybody's really good. Everybody believes in themselves. So, you know, chances are you are going to lose a lot. So you have to have the right mindset, the right maturity level to be able to handle failure and disappointment.
I think that's a great outlook on the decision to go to college or not. It's that it can really make an impact on your long-term career. I would also love to hear a little bit about potentially if playing in the college tennis environment brought out a little bit more in your doubles game. Did that impact that part of your career at all?
I think it did, because when I played college tennis, the format was different than it is now. We actually played singles first, and then we played doubles, and it was a full match, and each doubles match counted. I know now it's different. Doubles is first, and it's the congregation of the three matches that gets the 1 point. But back when I played, you know, I remember the one thing it taught me was even if I lost a tough singles match, I was going to come back and win the doubles for myself, but more importantly for the team. So it gave you an opportunity. I remember that specifically. It gave you an opportunity to reset, right? Handle, like, get knocked down and do you get back up? So I think that helped me a lot, just being able, because when I first turned pro, obviously I played singles and doubles. I played singles for a long time. It wasn't until I think maybe 10 years into my career that I just played doubles. So I was used to playing multiple matches, singles, doubles, losing in a singles match, having to come back and win a doubles, or losing in a doubles and the next morning having to come back to play singles. So I was kind of used to, you know, being able to separate the wins and losses between the two disciplines. So I think that helped me a lot. Obviously, I don't know. It's interesting. You know, it's funny. I had someone ask me the other day, Jimmy Arias, actually, you know, former top five player in the world, asked me, how did you get so good at volleying? Because, you know, we were at voluntaries and nobody was really that skilled at volleying. But, you know, I owe that to my parents. My mom was kind of a servant volleyer. So she taught me how to volley at a very young age. And it's just something that came very natural to me. So I think playing a lot of doubles at, you know, college allowed me to kind of foster that ability and allowed me to get even better.
I love that. And then, like you mentioned, you had a pretty successful singles career before you really started focusing on the double side. What was that like early on in your career, getting to play at these tournaments that I'm sure when you were a junior, you watched on TV and all that kind of stuff? What was that like to experience?
Yeah, I mean, it's awesome, right? I mean, you know, got to play all the majors, you know, I remember obviously Wimbledon always stood out for me, right? I actually was fortunate. My mom, since she played, you know, and she was from England, I think when I was, might have been right when I went to the academy, my mom was able to get tickets to Wimbledon. We flew over. Borg had won 5 Wimbledons in a row. Borg was my idol. So we flew over just to see Borg win it a 6th time. And he played Johnny Mack in the final, and Johnny Mack was beating him. I remember I was so disappointed. I walked outside the stadium. I walked far away to where now the new court 2 is, just like, you know, praying and hoping that Borg would win. Came back, and of course Mack won. So I was disappointed because all I wanted to see was Borg go to his knees and win. But you know, it's just kind of then all of a sudden fast forward, I don't know, 15 years or whatever. Of course I'd played the juniors and had some success in the juniors, but playing, you know, at the professional level at Wimbledon, like, wow, I'm part of this. Seeing your name up on the board, like, you see people queuing for days to come watch you play. Like, you know, it's that moment, right, where you're like, wow, this is really cool, right? This has been worth it. So that was awesome. You know, I mean, I feel, you know, I had some good moments in my singles career. I definitely look back that I could have done better for sure. There are a couple of things that held me back. Like I said, it put a lot of pressure on myself. Mentally probably was my worst enemy. You know, but you live and learn, right? I know that, you know, there, and I think that's important also for the juniors, right? Is that at the end of the day, even though I believe, or let's say I had these lofty goals, there was a part of me where there was a doubt when I was playing singles, like, am I good enough to, you know, win a major in singles? Am I good enough to get to the final weekend? All these types of things, get to the second week. And maybe I didn't believe enough, right? And that probably hurt me. Whereas when I started doing really well in the doubles, I always believed in doubles. I think right from the beginning, my first professional tournament, I was lucky enough to play with my good friend, former world number one, Jim Courier. We got a wild card in the Masters 1000 in Montreal, my first tournament, and we won it. And, you know, I just believed right from the beginning that I was the best doubles player on the court. And people were looking at me like, what's wrong with this guy? Is he crazy? Like, you know, who does he think he is? But I maybe didn't have that mentality enough in singles, which probably hurt me, because if I look back at my good buddies, you know, Andre and Jim and so forth, they had incredible, you know, inner belief, right? They believed that they were going to win. They believed that they were the best. So I think that's an important message for the juniors, right? It, you know, at the end of the day, and I always say it's mental, right? But it's about belief. You got to believe in yourself, you know, not, and I'd heard, you know, other people say you should be this, you should be that, whatever. But at the end of the day, the athlete, the junior has to believe. That's the most important part.
Yeah, I love that. And that's one of the things I was going to ask you actually was what the mentality difference is like for you between doubles and singles. So it was great that you kind of touched on that a little bit there. What about playing doubles kind of gave you that confidence and turned you into that type of player on the court?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, maybe college tennis did that, right? Because, I mean, you play, like I said, you play as an individual most of your life. The first time you feel part of a team is college tennis. And like I said, it was very natural for me from when I turned pro, when I was on a doubles court. I mean, it helped to have a great player besides me, like Jim Courier. But still, I remember my mindset, like, I'm the best player on this court. And I don't know if I had that specific mindset when I played singles a lot of the time. You know, maybe there were some doubts. I would walk on the court thinking I was the best and I was going to win the match. But maybe, you know, as the match wore on, you start to doubt yourself. Whereas, I mean, I, from what I can remember, honestly, I don't ever remember walking on a doubles court and thinking that I wasn't the best player on the court. And maybe that's because of the skills that I possessed. You know, maybe it's the kind of combination of skills that allows you to have that belief. Maybe there were some holes in my game on the singles court that didn't allow me to have that belief. But ultimately, like I said, unfortunately, it comes down to mindset, right? The power of the mind is very strong, and it took me a while to develop that. And I think, you know, it might have hurt me early on in my singles career. And like I said, I was able to have some big wins and some good moments on the singles court, but maybe not as much as not as many as I should have.
Yeah, no, that totally makes sense. I think it's really cool for me to be able to go to all the national junior tournaments and see players play singles in the morning and then get on the court and play doubles in that afternoon with somebody. You can just feel the energy changes. It's a little bit more exciting, and I love the competitiveness that everybody has, and it's and the team part of the game. So I know I like to see that. And obviously, you have a pretty long career, spanned, 20 years, 20 plus?
Yeah, a long time. I mean, I played my first professional tournament probably when I was like 15. And like I say, I played a couple of professional tournaments, but as an amateur, and then went to school and then officially turned pro in 92, retired in 2012. So 21 official years, but I played a number of years before as well. So.
No, we always talk about like you see burnout on the junior circuit where kids are going really heavy with it in the young years. And then by the time they're 16, 18, they don't love the game anymore. How are you able to have such a long career? What were some of the things that went into that longevity?
Well, I think it goes back to kind of what I said initially, right? The love and passion for the sport. And I think, you know, we're seeing that even more. Like if you see... Like I said, you know, you see Roger, Novak, all these guys playing at such a late age. You take a guy like Andy Murray. He's accomplished everything. He's, you know, he's won a bunch of majors, three majors, first one to win Wimbledon in umpteen years, you know, several hip surgeries, never going to come back. And here he is still going. Like, I still have people that text me and go, why is Andy Murray still playing? And I'm like, listen, he absolutely loves the sport of tennis. Like, what's better than doing something that you love, right? Like, I mean, we don't know how long we're on this earth. So why not, you know, check in, clock in every day doing something that you love to do. So I think that that's fascinating, right? And I think for me, the reason I had a long career is, you know, I love tennis. I really do. I mean, listen, there are a lot of great moments. I had a lot of great moments in my career, and there are a lot of heartbreaks as well. You know, I lost a number of Grand Slam finals. And I remember those feelings after losing, and I don't wish those on my worst enemy. Those are brutal. I mean, I still remember them vividly, but like I said, it's all part of the process, right? Like, you know, tennis is one of those things. You can only win or lose. There's no draw. It's not soccer, right? You can't tie. So you've got to deal with it. I think also I'm extremely competitive. I really love to compete. I mean, even now, when I find myself playing other sports, I need to have like a little talk with myself and like calm down a little bit. Don't compete so hard, right? Like that competitive fire just kicks in. So, you know, I think you probably find the same with most players, most athletes that have a long career, whatever sport it is that, you know, they love the fact of competing. You know, I think the other thing that I used to love was the feeling of self-accomplishment. Like at the end of the day, having won a match, you know, you go back to the hotel, you look in the mirror and you're like, okay, all that hard work, you know, I put in the hours, went out there, I performed, I succeeded. That's pretty cool, right? Like, you know, get self-accomplishment. Of course, there are days where you don't get that accomplishment, but there are a lot of days where you feel like, you know, I was working towards something, I achieved that goal. You know, so I think that's important for juniors too. Like, it's harder now with social media, with all the pressures, with UTR. I would say it's harder now, but I would say just don't lose sight of the fact that, hey, if you love it, like continue to focus on being the best player you can be. That might come at 12 years old. That might come at 14. That may come at 19. You know, you look at a person like John Isner, never had any aspirations to play professional tennis, was able to go to the University of Georgia, had a great coach there in Manny Diaz, all of a sudden started to foster that belief and goes on to have an absolutely extraordinary career, right? Just incredible career. And he probably would not have forecasted that when he was 13 or 14, and maybe nobody else would have, right? So it just goes to show that everybody has their own path, but try not to get too caught up in the pressures of, I guess, everyday life as far as, you know, parents' expectations, coaches' expectations, agents' expectations, UTR points, all those things. Think about the long term, right? And tennis is one of those sports you need to think about the long term because, like I said earlier, the skills that you need as a professional might not necessarily be the skills that you needed as a junior. Because as players get bigger, stronger, grow, a lot of different things, a lot of different factors. I think Carlos Alcaraz is probably obviously the most shining example. You know, coming after the big three, no one would ever expect, but the reality is he's might be the perfect combination of all three of them, right? Like he was able to learn, take something from each of them, and work on. He wasn't a guy who played a number of junior tournaments. Jannik Sinner is the same, played no junior tournaments, right? Just had a great coach, had people around him that long-term goals. And I think that's important for parents with their kids and their juniors. Like, okay, what's your goal? Like, do you want to be the best junior? Okay, we can do your game to be the best junior. Or do you want to have the best ability to be go to a top college, right? Okay, we can try to work your game to that. Or are you even thinking further long term? Like, I want to be a professional tennis player. I don't know if many juniors know because it's been a while, but Pete Sampras' story is the shining example, right? He and his coach decided at, I think it was 12 years old, we're going to switch from a two-handed backhand to a one-handed backhand. And he lost for a year straight. He lost to people he knew he was better than. He had to deal with the losing as a 12-year-old, which is hard. And the mindset was, you're going to need a one-hander if we're going to be the best professional player we can be. You're going to be a serve and volleyer. You're going to need the slice. You're going to need the one-hander. And you know what? Pretty good decision. 14 Grand Slams later, right? So, but not everyone has that ability to look long term because of the immediate pressures. And it's understandable, and especially now because, everybody wants to know what your UTR is. How many matches did you win? Blah, blah, blah. And that's it's hard.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I mean, I see that on a daily basis, the pressure that the juniors are going through today with like what you said, that there's all the metrics that are out there and everything with social media. So I think that's a really great mindset that you talked about there, is having that long-term vision and then just staying disciplined and working towards it every day. So I think that's great. And obviously towards as you wrapped up your career, you got into some really cool stuff off the court. You did some coaching, and then obviously all the stuff you do with Tennis Channel, and then you're also pretty involved, I believe, with growing tennis in the Bahamas. I would love to hear a couple things. Let's start with the coaching side of what you did. What was that like working with highly competitive tennis players in that capacity, as opposed to playing with them or against them or anything like that?
Yeah, it was pretty cool. Obviously, towards the end of my career, I started to work a little bit with Marty Fish. We were playing a little bit of doubles together as well at the end of my career. And then once I retired, he's like, are you interested in coaching me, traveling with me a little bit? And I'd known Marty from competing against him, and ultimately admiring his game. I always thought, like, wow, this guy's got incredible skill. And I always felt he could do better than he had done. So, it was a nice opportunity for me. Like I said, I felt that I could add a lot of value. I mean, like I said, I felt that there were things I could have done better in my career, especially in my singles career. But I can't go back in time, but what I can do is help somebody else. So I really felt like, it was really a really good opportunity to work with Marty. And he ended up same type of thing. I think he didn't necessarily feel that he could be a top 10 player or be a certain level. And I was able to kind of get him to believe in himself. And then all of a sudden his skills really started to shine. He played great. He, committed himself physically. Ultimately he did all the work. But, as a coach, I think just the ability to try to connect to a player, and that's what I was saying, like, you're just trying to get this specific individual to fulfill their potential. And, for Marty, that was kind of the mindset. And for me, it was such an exciting challenge because, like I said, I knew the things that I did right in my career and I knew the things that I did wrong. So he was very open, which is fully credit to him. He listened to pretty much everything I said. So it was a joy for me when you have a pupil or, a player that's willing to kind of listen and really respect your thoughts and your opinions. you know, then it's probably going to be a successful relationship. And it was. So that was, you know, super exciting. Then after Marty, I coached Jack Sock a little bit. You know, and it was a short relationship. He got injured a little bit, so that was a bit unfortunate because super talented athlete and, you know, incredible skill set as well. Then I coached Milos Raonic for a while, which was also exciting. You know, all players that have incredible talent. You know, I remember the first week I worked with Milos, they called me right before the grass court season. And he was defending finalists, obviously. So it was probably, and I think he was struggling a little bit with his confidence. And they called me to see if I wanted to work with him. And, you know, probably not the right time to sign up with him defending Wimbledon finals. But I knew how good this guy was. I was like, yes, you know. So I remember the first week I was with him, I called my wife and I was like, holy cow, this guy's incredible. Like, he's such a good player. Like, you know, like, I had known him, I'd played him when I played and so forth, just, you know, big server, but he was such a great athlete. You know, so just, I think the ability, the opportunity to connect with some of these great athletes, great players, give them a bit of my advice, my experiences, and see how it maybe fit into their mindset, how they see the game. It's really cool, right? I mean, you know, I think for all of us former players, we can't go back in time. So the only way we can make a difference is by helping others. So that, I think that was the beauty of coaching, is that, you know, I really enjoy coaching. I really enjoy helping others. I've always felt that I see the game really well. And, you know, the game is always easier from this position outside the court. But I always felt that I saw the game well. So I felt that it was kind of a nice connection to be able to connect with a player.
I love that. And then earlier we briefly mentioned football, and you have a pretty talented member of your family who's doing big things on the gridiron out there as a quarterback for South Lake Carroll. He's going to be playing at Georgia Tech, I believe. Your son Graham. How have or let's say have those experiences you had coaching tennis impacted your ability to connect with Graham and help your son get to the level that he's been able to on the football field?
Yeah, it's been awesome. You know, we're so proud of him. He's done such an incredible job. You know, I've always said, and I truly believe this, quarterback is the toughest position in all of sports. I mean, it's not even close. So it takes a different mindset. And, you know, I think that probably my experience as an athlete, I was able to kind of diagnose his personality and his mentality. And, you know, that's what I remember the most. My wife and I would speak often. The one thing that stood out to me about Graham was his mentality. He was so even keeled. He was a great leader. You know, besides his, he obviously had the physical skills, you know, strong athletic kid. But more importantly, like I said, the mind is more important than the physical side in any sport almost. So, you know, I saw some characteristics where I was like, I think he could be a great quarterback. I probably couldn't have been a great quarterback because I was a little bit more emotionally up and down and, you know, probably wouldn't have handled, you know, interceptions or those types of things as well. But, you know, he had a great mentality. So I think, you know, possibly, I don't know, I won't speak for him, but you know, I think my wife and I are both very sporty. My wife is very athletic as well. So we're a very sporty household, and we've never pressured our kids for any sport. You know, we play a lot of sports in our house. Graham was never really interested in tennis, which is kind of ironic because I was doing good things when he was a kid. I remember putting him in the trophies all the time after I'd win. And you know, so he was around tennis all the time, but you know, he plays for fun, but he was more of a team sport guy. He's like, I love team sports and all those things. So, you know, I think still, you know, he's accomplished a lot and he's got a bright future ahead of him, but it's the same thing. Like, hey, as long as you love it and you're passionate about it and, you know, whatever your goals are, whatever, you know, just try to fulfill your potential. Nobody really knows what that is. But if you love it, you know, hard work and discipline, all those things. And like I said, belief is the key ingredient. So, you know, it's exciting for him. And, you know, same, we have two other kids, another son, Brody, loves basketball, really good basketball player. He was actually he plays a lot of tennis, but I'm losing him to tennis. I'm losing him. The team sports are taking over because he plays football too. He's a wide receiver, and which is fine, totally fine. And then our daughter, she plays tennis, so it's fine. So, like I said, we have no expectations as far as college or professional. Obviously, it's nice that it's come to fruition for Graham. You know, the opportunity to go to an incredible school like Georgia Tech. You know, that's really it's exciting. So we're excited and proud of him.
That's awesome. I'm sure a lot of the parents that are listening out there would be able to resonate with raising children that are athletes. And I'm sure they would love to hear any insight you have on helping your kids shape that winning mentality that it sounds like they all have. If you have anything you can share, any tips there, I think that'd be great.
Yeah, I mean, I think the number one thing is, like I said even earlier, like you got to be able to embrace adversity, right? Of all the great athletes there have been in every sport, no one has had a perfect record. Everybody has struggled, whether they've lost, whether they've been cut from a team, whether they've missed a free throw at the end of the game, whether they've thrown an interception, whether they've double faulted on match point. It's like everybody has failed, right? I mean, so I think it's hard for a kid because I also remember being a kid. Like you take all of that stuff personally, right? You take it like, oh, I stink. I'm not good. I can never do this. I'm not clutch. All these things, and I think it's important just to kind of educate them that it's okay to fail, right? As long as you get up, it's how you respond. I mean, it's very cliche, but it's really hard to do. There's a lot of us that fail and we stay down, right? We don't get back up. You know, don't judge yourself so harshly, right? Like, you know, I remember always hearing from my parents, you learn the most from your losses. And I was like, no, I don't want to hear that ever again. But you know, you hear it all the time because it is true, right? You know, first of all, you get a chance to correct things and do better next time, but you also know how to respond and deal with adversity a little bit better. So, you know, I think for us, like, it's still about fun and joy. You know, my oldest son, actually, Graham, the quarterback, was actually a really good baseball player. And believe it or not, baseball is my favorite sport. If I could have played any sport, it probably would have been baseball. I just didn't grow up around it. I love baseball. So I actually used to coach him, you know, little league baseball. And then, you know, he knew how much I love baseball. And then when he was 12 years old, he actually wrote me a letter. He couldn't tell me, but he wrote me a letter saying, hey, Dad, I know you're going to be super disappointed, whatever, but I don't really enjoy baseball anymore. And he was really good. And so I looked at the letter and I was like, wow. I'm like, you never have to play baseball ever again. Like, did you ever feel? And it just goes to show that parent-kid relationship. Like, even though I'd never put pressure on him per se, he felt the pressure, like, oh, this is what my dad wants me to do. It's what my dad loves. He loves baseball. I can't, like, it took him so long to have the heart to say, I'm not really enjoying baseball. And so when I told him, I go, dude, you never have to play baseball ever again. He was like stunned. He's like, really? And I was like, yeah, I don't ever want you to play anything that you don't love and have fun doing. And he was like, he was stunned, right? So I think that's important. And it's not easy for a lot of parents to just go. And we literally have never, we've never played baseball since. So maybe in the backyard playing, like, you know, and he still, we'll watch baseball together. We'll do all those things and we'll talk about it. But that's so important, right? And he was gifted. He was a really good baseball player. So maybe there's some parents that would have forced that situation, but my wife and I would never about that. And I think the vantage point that I have, having gone to an academy at 10 years old, I've seen the good, I've seen the bad. You know, at the end of the day, I think as parents, it's good to guide your kids, but ultimately your parents, I mean, your kids have to kind of, you'll get a feeling for what they really love and what they're really passionate about.
I think that's a very refreshing approach to parenting and to developing children in athletics. So I really appreciate your insight there. And now it's time we unfortunately have to wrap it up here. But I really want to thank you, Mark. You had some incredible insight that I think junior players across the country, their parents, and really anybody that's trying to be the best they can be on the tennis court could take from today's conversation. So just really want to thank you for taking the time.
Awesome. Thanks for having me on, and hopefully it helps somebody.